Why?
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Bennett Miller won the Best Director Prize at Cannes this year for his film Foxcatcher. It's about the 1996 murder of Olympic gold medal wrestler Dave Schultz by multimillionaire John DuPont. He was murdered in front of witnesses on DuPont's sprawling estate in Newtown Square outside of Philadelphia. It was a tragic event that captivated the region and the nation, that also shed light on the eccentric and increasingly bizarre behavior of DuPont, who was found guilty of third-degree murder but mentally ill. He died in prison in 2010. We're going to explore this story from several different perspectives with Nancy Schultz, Dave's widow, Joe McGettigan, one of the prosecutors, and Bill Ordean, who covered this trial for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We begin our conversation with Harlan Jacobson. He's a film critic, host of Talk Cinema, and he saw Foxcatcher at Cannes. And Harlan Jacobson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here, Marty.
So what about Bennett Miller's directing earned him a Best Director Award at Cannes?
It was a beautiful job. It was a completely controlled tone. He never really sensationalized the facts. It was filmed almost, it was a color film, but it was almost a gray and slate blue kind of color palette. His cinematographer, Greg Fraser, who's done really some rather wonderful work in other films like Zero Dark Thirty, was on his absolutely best behavior to keep it all very close to the vest, I think. And so it allowed you the room to fill in the characters. You didn't need the craziness that was the actual John DuPont. To the extent that you could simply live with the characters and find them as people and find them credible.
I was watching a clip of Steve Carell, his performance of John DuPont. It doesn't work on the radio because there are so many subtle things that he's doing with his face, his voice even. It's a scene where he's talking with Mark Schultz. Talk to us a bit about Steve Carell's performance, which sounds a little out of character for him.
Well, you know, why he would go from being a complete idiot in the office to a lethal idiot in this film is, I think, just the trajectory of any ambitious actor who wants to test his wings a little bit. And it's exactly right what you say, Marty, about you can't hear on the radio when he looks down his rather long nose at people and surveys virtually the entire world down that nose from a point of condescension, as I used to have an old boss say, from no particular height. In fact, if anything, he had a kind of a deficit, as Carell played him, of self-respect, owing to a whole host of reasons, but not the least of which was a kind of inferiority delivered to him by his mother, Jean DuPont, who seemed to value horse showing as a mainline activity rather than sort of keeping a stable of wrestlers out there on a tricked-up barn known as the Foxcatcher.
Right. And it's a prosthetic nose, just talking about Steve Carell, yes?
Yes, and Carell said actually that they even toned the nose down, that his nose was bigger in real life, which I don't actually know, so I'll have to take Steve Carell's word for it.
What was the audience reaction when they saw Foxcatcher?
Loved it. The Cannes critic is a collection of worldwide critics is a fairly discerning audience from a film standpoint. It's not always to say that it's in touch with reality, but they really rather liked the film because it was not a sensationalized film. It wasn't a Hollywood film. If anything, it was an American art film. There's a point when John DuPont says to Mark Schultz, whose performance he's pleased with at a competition, and offers him a $10,000 bonus just for being such a good wrestler, that I think we're friends now, he says. Mm-hmm. And you can call me Eagle or Golden Eagle. And that got a huge laugh at Ken. And it's a tough audience to get to laugh. So I think that the film went over extraordinarily well.
Channing Tatum plays Mark Schultz, and Mark Ruffalo plays David Schultz. How would you describe Ruffalo's performance?
He was He was charming. He was centered. He was grounded. He was the star brother to Mark's somewhat more reticent brother. He was the dominant brother. Mark Ruffalo was everything that Mark Ruffalo can be on film, which is to say smart, knowing, verbal, and charming, which fit in nicely with the brother dynamic as portrayed in the film.
And was filmed not outside of Philadelphia, but actually outside of Pittsburgh. Do you know why?
Yeah, I asked Bennett Miller about that. I was particularly interested in that because it looked like parts of the main line that we all know and love, but in fact, it was filmed at an unnamed estate outside of Pittsburgh, and a family that Miller said was, you know, somewhat like the DuPonts, and which I took to mean Mellons, more than likely, on a much larger estate. And he said it's strictly because they got a better union contract out of the Pittsburgh IATSE office than they did out of the Philly one.
Well, that's what it takes, I guess, to make movies in America these days. So when is Foxcatcher going to open in the U.S.?
It opens, I believe, in November by Sony Pictures Classics. I think they're eyeing an Oscar run for it, and that's when films like this that come out of major film festivals, and it's really a misnomer festival. They're really marketplaces, Cannes, Sundance, Toronto. They're really positioning films for the marketplace and for distributors like Sony to make a run at Oscar bait.
And we should add that the director also directed Capote and Moneyball, so he has a bit of a track record.
Yes, and particularly in doing characters who think outside the box.
Well, Harlan Jacobson, thank you for joining us and getting our conversation started.
Always a pleasure, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's film critic, host of Talk Cinema, and he saw the film Foxcatcher when it opened at Cannes earlier this month. Joining us now is Bill Ordine, and he covered the Dave Schultz murder trial when he was a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, co-wrote a book with Ralph Vigoda called Fatal Match, actually part of the paper's Pulitzer finalist team in breaking news that covered the Schultz case. He's now editor of Philly Gambles.com, and that's a website that covers gambling in and around Philadelphia. And Bill Ordine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
And
good to be here, Maureen.
Nice to have you with us. And it's such a horrifying story, and it's such a strange story at the same time. Do you remember the day of this terrible murder?
Like it was yesterday. It was obviously it was January day in 1996, and Ralph and I were in our the suburban mainline suburban bureau when our editor heard on the police scanner that there had been an event out at the DuPont estate. And several months prior to that, there had been a fire out there that didn't get a lot of notice from us. And, you know, we weren't getting a lot of information from the authorities. So, you know, we went out there with Ralph going to the estate and me going to the police station, and it all kind of fell together rather quickly.
And from your reporting, as you were piecing this story together, how would you describe John Eleuther DuPont?
He was a person missing a lot of some parts that most of us have, and emotionally, in particular, he was just missing some of the parts that what we would call average folks have. And consequently, it drove him to do these very eccentric things. It drove him to try to manipulate his world with money and influence. And he was almost robotic in certain ways. You got the sense that he was missing this human aspect that most folks have. And yet he would try to make up for it by being sometimes overly generous, but it never quite worked for him.
He helped to found, or maybe he did found or fund, the Delaware Museum of Natural History, of course, part of this very wealthy and well-known DuPont family. He seemed to have an interest in science and the natural world.
He did, and it was something that he cultivated from a very early age. And as Harlan pointed out, you know, he was somewhat the victim of an odd upbringing. It really was like a 19th century upbringing. He was left in that big house with his mother. His siblings were all much older than he was. His father was absent. And so it was, you know, himself, his mother, and the servants. And he probably spent more time with the servants than he did his mother. Mm. And so he wound up, you know, latching on to, you know, this love of nature. He cultivated it. But like a lot of his problem, projects, Marty, there was almost an overwhelming sense of vanity in what it was that he was being a patron of, more than an authentic goal, motivation of advancing either science or sports. You got the sense that it was really more about him trying to make, you know, fill a place in himself.
What was his interest in wrestling, or even amateur and Olympic wrestling?
Well, actually, it was the kind of the culmination of a series of athletic interests. His first interest was in swimming, where he tried to be a swimmer on, you know, at a big fancy college in California, along with national caliber swimmers. That fizzled. Then he tried to be a pentathlete. That fizzled. Then he started a swimming program at Foxcatcher. That fizzled. Then he had triathletes come there and work out. That fizzled. And then finally the wrestling. Hmm. So it was part of a long string of him trying to be a modern Medici, if you will, in terms of sports.
About a minute before our break here, but he did build arena, is that too big a word, but a facility on his estate.
He had a number of those kinds of things. Like he had a firing range. That was part of the pentathlete thing. He had a swimming pool. He had this wrestling gymnasium. Basically, he had sort of a miniature Olympic training facility right there at Foxcatcher, and it was the sort of thing that he used to lure all those wrestlers there.
And the name Foxcatcher, that was the name of his father's racing stable. Do I have that right?
You're correct. Actually, that estate had been put together by his mother's father, and then went after his mother and father get married, William, who had an enormous interest in a very robust equine pursuits like horse racing and fox hunting, changed the name to Foxcatcher.
And that's Bill Ordean, and he, when he was at the Philadelphia Inquirer, covered the murder trial of Dave Schultz. He was murdered by multimillionaire John DuPont. This was January 1996 on the DuPont estate in Delaware County, just outside of Philadelphia. It's the subject of a new film that had its opening at Cannes called Foxcatcher. There's also a documentary that's being made about Dave Schultz. And we're going to take some calls after this very short break. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Also continue our conversation with Bill Ordean. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Mike McGrath, host of You Bet Your Garden, inviting you to join us as we deter your deer, slay your slugs, and try to stop your evil squirrels. All without dangerous chemicals, of course. On You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
The Pulse tells stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
This is my health. We're not just a body, we're not just a head.
Robots are really just computers with motors.
The speed at which they can process information, their ability to filter.
In addition to your knee pain, you're also dealing with insomnia.
The Pulse, Friday morning at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Nevada's former water czar shares some lessons she's learned working in one of the driest parts of the U.S. She says we all need to think more about water.
We still, in many corners of the country, take it for granted. And it's going to be one of the most challenged resources of the next century.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Bill Ordine about a murder that happened almost 20 years ago in suburban Philadelphia. John DuPont killed gold medal wrestler Dave Schultz. John DuPont ended up in prison, in fact died in prison. It was a tragic event that captivated the region and the nation. It's now the subject of a new movie. We are looking back at the Schultz murder, and we will be talking about DuPont's trial and conviction and the mystery that still surrounds his motives. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Bill, how would you describe then the relationship between John DuPont and Dave Schultz? Dave, a well-known Olympic wrestler, living on the DuPont estate for a number of years.
Well, Dave Schultz was this legendary figure in wrestling and a guy who commanded enormous respect in that wrestling world. And I think even John DuPont, for as condescending as he could be regarding most people, had to accept Schultz's, place within that universe. And the interesting dynamic between those two is that In simple terms, Dave Schultz was one of the few people who could talk sense to John DuPont.
Interesting.
Who could get John in line when John was going off the rails. And that was no easy feat for anyone. But it showed the sort of demeanor that Dave Schultz had, that he could address a guy who basically could tell anyone to go jump in the lake and they would do it for a big enough check. That Dave Schultz could tell this guy who was used to getting his own way, "Look, John, we shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't be doing this." And John DuPont would actually listen.
That's interesting. But it seemed that over time, or just became more apparent, that John DuPont was losing touch with reality. He had, he claimed to be, if not the Dalai Lama or some incarnation of the Dalai Lama, it looked like he had some paranoid fears and fantasies. Help us understand, I guess, what was going on in his mind.
Well, such is the nature of one being irrational, one being delusional, and in his case, it was all the above. I mean, he had hallucinations, he was delusional, he was paranoid, and it was all exacerbated, the prosecution contended at trial, by alcohol use and drug use. So it was a bad cocktail going on inside John DuPont's head.
So what happened on January 26, 1996?
Well, on that day, John DuPont was in the midst of an activity that most of us would consider bizarre to begin with. He had with him a security expert, and that security expert had been tasked with finding a machine gun for one of John DuPont's toys, a tank that he had. John DuPont had a tank on the estate that was not armed, and John DuPont thought it would be an okay idea to arm that thing, but that's not an easy thing to acquire, that kind of armament. So this fellow was discussing that with DuPont. Whether or not it was ever going to happen, we're not sure. And they were driving around DuPont's estate inspecting storm damage. This was January. And John DuPont has with him an enormous handgun, which was not unusual for John DuPont, because he often carried a gun with him around the estate. They drive into Dave Schultz's driveway, who lives on the estate. He lives on one of the houses, one of the many buildings on the DuPont estate in Newtown Square. And David is working on his car radio. And David sees John DuPont pull up with the security guy next to him. And Dave Schultz says, something like, "Hiya, coach," or "What's up, coach," but gives him a warm greeting.
Mm-hmm.
And John DuPont says, "You have a problem with me," and reaches out the window with his .44 Magnum and shoots David Schultz three times. The final time, while David Schultz is lying on the ground.
Did he ever explain why he shot Dave Schultz?
This remains always, Marty, why did he do it?
Right.
The prosecution has its own explanations for why this happened. But from John DuPont's lips, no. We never learned what really, specifically, motivated John DuPont to kill someone that many people would have considered his best friend.
And killed Dave Schultz on the spot, and we'll be talking with Dave Schultz's widow in about 20 yes. minutes or so, but she witnessed, it looks like she saw that third shot being fired.
Yeah, it had to be absolutely horrifying.
Absolutely.
And she, you know, was over her husband as he was bleeding out, and while the police were being called, yeah, it had to be horrible.
Mm. Let me get to Annie, actually, to join us. Annie calling us from Kennett Square. Annie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to call because Evie, his older sister, Evie DuPont, used to come and stay with my mother-in-law in Kennett Square. And my husband and mother-in-law were with Evie. They were actually sitting at her kitchen table when the news came over about John killing Dave Schultz.
Wow.
And the issue a few weeks earlier was around Christmas time. Evie had tried to go see John, and he refused her entrance into the house until she called him, referred to him as the Dalai Lama, and she wasn't about to do that. She was a crusty lady. Wow. And she wasn't about to kowtow to John, so she left. So she never did get to see him. He had a lot of handlers around him, and it was very hard for the family to get in and see John. He paid a lot of people to keep everybody away. So it was difficult for the family.
Indeed. I mean, obviously, very, very tragic family story. Annie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Bill, anything you want to add to that?
No, with the lady, what Annie just said, I think is really kind of pertinent to any discussion about John DuPont. When she mentioned handlers, I mean, he really was quite insulated, and he insulated himself with money by the, you know, this whole cadre of people who performed all types of functions for on his behalf around the estate, so that he was actually able to operate within this bubble, and this is why the craziness was able to go on. The word enabling is mm-hmm. all over this situation.
And we have Joe McGettigan waiting in the wings, but I want to ask you just one more question before we get Joe in on the conversation, Bill. And this is what happens after John DuPont shot Dave Schultz, is that he then holds up in his mansion, in his house for, what, 2 days, something like that?
2 days, yes. Yes, ma'am.
And there's a SWAT team. I mean, the police are on the grounds, what, trying to get him out of the house, and how were they able to do that?
Well, and Joe could tell you this as well as I could, but there were some skillful negotiations by, I believe, a policeman from Upper Darby, if I remember that's where he was from, a fellow by the name of Paparo, who talked John DuPont out. The police had inadvertently wound up turning off the heating system to the mansion. And this is January. John DuPont gets mm-hmm. cold. He wants to go out and fix the heating system, and a police negotiator says, "Go ahead, John. You just leave your guns behind so no one gets hurt. You come out and fix the heating system, and then you can go back to the house." Well, of course, John DuPont buys that, and he goes out to try to fix the heating system, and, of course, a bunch of police jump out and grab him, and that's how it all came to an end.
And that's Bill Ordine, our guest, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about a murder that happened January 26, 1996, just outside of Philadelphia in Delaware County. Multimillionaire John DuPont murdered Olympic gold medal wrestler Dave Schultz, who was living on DuPont's estate. Bill Ordine wrote about it in a book that he co-authored with Ralph Vigoda called Fatal Match. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Joining us now is Joe McGettigan. He's an attorney in private practice with McAndrews Law Firm, and back in 1996 and 1997, he co-prosecuted John DuPont for the murder of Dave Schultz. And Joe McGettigan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you this morning.
So what was your approach to the prosecution?
It was a very complicated matter, as you can imagine, and we saw immediately that what the defense would be, that it would be an insanity defense. In fact, during the time that the defendant was barricaded, I was already making calls to forensic psychiatrists because I had gathered some of the background of DuPont during the couple of days that he was holed up. So we knew what the defense would be because there really was literally no other defense. And he did have an extensive background in psychiatric issues. I should point out, however, that I was a co-prosecutor in the case with my friend and present colleague, Dennis McAndrews.
Oh, yes, indeed.
McAndrews Law Offices.
Absolutely.
He was the brains of the outfit, so I have to always remember to
give him a shout
that.
Out. But in reading about the trial, and I'll get back to you, Bill, I mean, it seems like it really boiled down to psychiatric witnesses, and both sides had psychiatrists who witnessed about, I guess, the state of mind of John DuPont. What did your psychiatric witnesses, what was their analysis, Joe?
Well, there is no question that DuPont had a longstanding history of mental health issues, but they were exacerbated by alcohol, by drug use. And one of the things that's that the state of the law in Pennsylvania makes pretty clear that the bar to cross to demonstrate legal insanity is a very high one.
Right.
And it was clear that DuPont knew both the nature and quality of his acts, and that he knew they were wrong. And that's a standard. If you know the nature and quality of what you're doing, and you know that it's wrong, then you're not legally insane. You may be mentally ill, and a jury so found, but you're not insane. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, because of his extraordinary history of peculiar behavior, I mean, bizarre behavior, and behavior that could reasonably be characterized as crazy, he did have a presentable case. And his counsel, he had a very good attorney in the case, trial attorney Tom Bergstrom, did a very good job of presenting that lengthy history of problems. He also underlined what Mr. Ordine has referenced, the enabling that went on that kind of allowed DuPont's behavior to grow and become more and more bizarre and entitled. Well, yeah, it was very strange.
Well, Bill, yeah, if you want to add to that, I'm sort of, I mean, I've heard this word enabling several times during this hour. How do you see it? And this is, of course, a very wealthy family.
It was, and it is. And the problem with the enabling, and Joe may have his own feelings on this, when you have that much money and that much influence, the problem is that the enabling was not just, if I can use the expression, on campus, not just on Foxcatcher, which was problematic to begin with. But these were all people that DuPont was able to basically buy. But the enabling extended beyond the boundaries of Foxcatcher.
Yeah, Bill, if I can say, it was as simple as some things like he used to pay some of these smaller wrestlers $1,000 to go inside the hollow walls of his mansion because he thought people were in there spying on him.
Mm.
And it extended to the point where, well, his name was on Villanova's sports facility for a while. So
right, on the DuPont Pavilion. It was called the DuPont Pavilion.
Yeah.
And Joe and I have discussed this for forever. And one of the issues that I think, well, I shouldn't speak, I'm not speaking for Joe, but one of the issues that always struck me is that prior to the Schultz homicide, John DuPont did a lot of things that should have caught the attention of local authorities. And had I pulled that stunt, or had Marty pulled that stunt, or Joe McGettigan, we'd have had a lot of explaining to do, and John DuPont didn't have to do a whole lot of explaining for those kinds of things.
Because he was a DuPont, or because he was a wealthy family?
Yeah. Do you recall that he struck a pedestrian in his in his car one day, I think on Lancaster Avenue, got out and said to the man, "You're fine," told somebody else to take care of it, drove to his estate, helicoptered to a private jet, and went to Michigan.
Hmm.
You know, he said, "I'm not going to deal with this."
Well, Joel, let me go back to you, and just because I need to understand... His lawyers were talking about a defense of a mental a defense about his mental state. He was found guilty of third-degree murder, but mentally ill. Translate mm-hmm. What does that mean, I guess, in a court of law?
Well, the continuation of the verdict guilty but mentally ill was not of tremendous practical consequence. It was really more of a legal acknowledgement that a person had a mental illness that may have contributed to their act, but did not excuse them from criminal liability. You know, so it basically directed the courts to make certain that the defendant was housed in a prison or other facility that allowed for the treatment of his mental illness. It did not excuse the crime. And it could, and perhaps in this case did, mitigate the sentence, but that's not necessarily the case. I mean, it was this came in the context of a time when the courts were still, as they are today, wrestling with the idea of what do you do with a person who has mental health issues that are obviously contributing to their actions, but do not serve as a legal excuse for them, like true insanity.
Bill, let me go back to you. And he was sentenced to 13 to 30 years in prison. He actually died in prison on December 9th, 2010. Do you know what his life was like in prison?
Vaguely. My understanding is that while I was in prison, sometimes he did some tutoring of other inmates. He maintained an interest in current events. He would read. But he would try to direct, I think, the activities back on Foxcatcher from the prison to the extent that he could. But my understanding is that his existence in prison was pretty drab.
Joe, was justice served by this sentence?
Well, he died in prison as he should have. So, you know, and the upshot of it was, as it should be, he spent the remainder of his life in prison. The verdict itself was an odd one in some respects. The jury was out an extraordinarily long period of time, the longest deliberations I'd had
really
up to that point in my career. Yeah, and they were wrestling with first degree and third degree. Technically, I had no doubt that it was a first degree murder. It was an intentional killing. And, you know, he obviously had the specific intent to kill. And I think defense counsel, in the case Tom Bergstrom, and I probably both would agree that third-degree murder was the most unlikely verdict. Or, you know, we thought not guilty by reason of insanity, guilty of first-degree murder.
Right.
But juries do strange things. In this case, they may have said, we're not going to find him not guilty by reason of insanity,
right,
but his mental illness was so severe that we will find him guilty of a reduced degree of murder. That's the only way I can analyze it.
Well, we have to end our conversation with you, Joe McGettigan. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
You too. He's an attorney in private practice and co-prosecuted John DuPont for the murder of Dave Schultz. Bill Ordine staying with us for the rest of the hour, and we have waiting in the wings Dave Schultz's widow. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Organizational Dynamics Professional Master's Degree Program at the University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY and is hosting an information session on campus Wednesday, June 11th from 6 to 8 p.m. The Organizational Dynamics Information Session will highlight this program designed to prepare management professionals for the evolving corporate challenges that may lie ahead. The Organizational Dynamics Professional Master's Degree Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Details at upenn.edu/dynamics.
For the record, Annie, you flirted with me. You made me feel like you really liked me, which was really unfair.
That's Chris O'Dowd as a police officer in Bridesmaids, the film that made him famous in America. He's now on Broadway, starring with James Franco in Of Mice and Men, and his autobiographical TV series is on Hulu. Chris O'Dowd on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
How the Snowden deal went down, along with the U.S. Constitution.
The documents reveal an NSA that say radically different things in private, that there should be no place where you can go and communicate free of the NSA's intrusive eye.
Glenn Greenwald on the public trust, why Edward Snowden came to him, and why we can never go back to our old assumptions about privacy. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Just to recap what we've been talking about, on January 16th, 1996, John DuPont killed Olympic gold medal wrestler Dave Schultz, who was living on DuPont's estate in suburban Philadelphia. DuPont died in a Pennsylvania prison in 2010. That murder and trial, the subject of a new film called Foxcatcher that was just shown at Cannes. There's also a documentary being made about Dave Schultz, and we've been talking about this with Bill Ordine. He covered the trial for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And joining us now is Nancy Schultz. She's the wife of wrestler Dave Schultz, who was murdered by John DuPont. She went on to create a wrestling foundation in his name and has remained active in the wrestling community. And Nancy Schultz, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. I know it's been almost 20 years, and I'm so sorry about what happened to your husband.
Thank you very much, Marty. I appreciate your sincerity.
You know, there's a new film. I know you and others have been working on a documentary. Are you ready to relive this tragedy?
I am. You know, it's been a long time since Dave's death, and I've had so much support. And actually, especially the documentary, which has been my heart and soul's work for the last 4 years, it's been really enjoyable to have Dave's friends and family talk about him. And especially in the documentary, it's about his life and his life on the Foxcatcher estate. And he was such a joyful person and such an amazing person that it's actually been a true wonderful experience to revisit his life and the amazing things he accomplished.
Have you been sort of worried that Dave Schultz, that his life was going to get lost in all the talk about John DuPont?
You know, Marty, I think that's exactly why I have been involved in all these projects. You know, I want Dave to be remembered for the amazing person he was, and not just for the way he was killed.
Right.
You know, he was an ambassador to a lot of countries when he was traveling. He, you know, met with princes and presidents. He was one of the most amazing technical wrestlers that ever touched a mat and throughout history. And all those things I want for him to be remembered, and a wonderful family man. And so for that reason, I was heavily involved with the formation of a Dave Schultz Wrestling Foundation, and then also this wonderful director, John Greenhall, who's made films for HBO and Independent Film Channel, came to me. Actually, in 2008 the first time, but I wasn't comfortable while DuPont was still alive to work on a film. So then in 2008, we started filming in more depth and started the project.
So why didn't you want this film to be made while DuPont was alive?
I think for me, I think DuPont had been made more famous by the murder, and I didn't want to continue that. I wanted the focus. If I was going to make a film about Dave, I want it to be about Dave. And obviously, the murder will be a part of it. That's how his life ended.
Yes.
And the complicated life on Foxcatcher. But I did want it to be the focus on Dave. And I think it was easier after DuPont had passed away in prison.
Help us understand, as you say, the complicated life on Foxcatcher. Then I want to get Bill Ordine back in on the conversation. Nancy,
yeah.
What was it like to live there? And I forget how many years you were living on the estate.
Dave and I were on the farm for 6 years. And I have to tell you, for 99% of the time, it was a sports utopia. It is very not very often that you find an environment where athletes can go there. There was wrestling, pentathlon, triathlon, equestrian. And there's this camaraderie of Olympic-level athletes competing with a common focus of becoming the best in the world at their specific sport. And we had a lot of families, so it was just this huge communal living that was amazing for becoming good in your sport.
And did DuPont see himself as the coach?
You know, I think we saw DuPont as a child king. He had a lot of mental health issues. He had a lot of drug and alcohol abuse. And I did want to address some of the issues that came up earlier about
sure.
the mental health and the enabling, which was, it's really hard with a person, especially with the kind of wealth that John had, to get help for someone. We tried many, many times to get him to seek mental health treatment. He was afraid that his family would take advantage of the situation and take control. He was afraid of his perception in the world, but it's really hard, especially with the wealth, to avoid the consequences that most of us face, to really force someone to get mental health treatment.
Bill, does that make sense to you, what Nancy is talking about?
It makes absolute sense, and I'm glad that Nancy took the conversation in that direction. I have often described this circumstance, this really terrible circumstance, as a Greek tragedy in the sense that there was almost an inevitability that something bad was going to happen. The something terrible that happened to Nancy's husband, a terrific person. But there was almost an inevitability that this money and that this influence was going to carry John DuPont's twisted mental state to a bad conclusion. We use the word enabling, but his money made this almost inevitable that something bad was going to happen to somebody.
And Bill, what did people tell you about Dave Schultz?
Everything that Nancy just said. I mean, and of course, I had been a sports writer prior to being a news reporter. Yeah, certainly I knew of David Schultz, and I knew of his enormous influence in the wrestling world. He was just a national figure. He was an international figure. The death of David Schultz was, in some ways, a bigger story in some international locations than it was in the United States, if that's imaginable. So
Dave was a true hero in many of the Eastern Bloc countries.
Interesting.
When we would go there, he was so famous we couldn't get off airplanes and get off buses. When we arrived in some of the countries over there, it was amazing.
Do you do you remember that day, Nancy? And even, my understanding is that you witnessed that third shot being fired at your husband.
I was there when David died. I did see the shot, and I was able to hold him and say goodbye to him. And that was...
That must have been horrifying. Absolutely horrifying.
I will say, though, that in working on this documentary, we have done interviews and found out a lot more interesting elements that led up to the few weeks before Dave's death, and some of the whys and how-tos and will be answered in the documentary, which is... It's been eye-opening for me, even in the investigation stage. John Greenhall has turned up a lot of interesting facts in the few days leading up to the death and the murder.
Anything you want to share with us, or do we need to wait to see the documentary?
Wait to see the documentary.
I saw a quote, and I'm sorry to keep going back to this terrible time in your life, but a quote when... obviously, he didn't have life in prison, even though he died in prison. But a quote that you said that he was talking about John DuPont, he was a kind of boogeyman for my children in some way. This is you talking, Nancy. Sometime he was going to get out, and we had no idea what his behavior was going to be. So until
Marty, it was a huge relief when John DuPont died in prison. Not only was he, a fear in my children's eyes, just because, a man killed their very strong and able father. So it's very hard for a child to process that kind of fear. And second, he continued to reach out after he was in prison. He had my children followed and videotaped. He had us followed. He continued to have a reach with his finances for a very long time to keep us in fear of him. And when the parole hearing stopped coming and he passed away in prison, it was a huge change in my life.
And you knew people were following you? I mean, you could see them?
Yes, and I have to say thanks to Joe McGettigan and Dennis McAndrews for the incredible prosecution they held. They were against more money, the wealthiest millionaire, that had ever been prosecuted for murder. And the litigation that was put up on DuPont's side was overwhelming to the DA's office. And they were still able to convict him. Mm-hmm. And they helped me afterwards, too. When DuPont was reaching out from prison and using private investigators, they helped me stop all of that as well. So I have to say thank you to Dennis McAndrews.
Yeah, indeed, and hopefully he's listening. Bill, you covered this trial for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and as Joe said, the jury deliberated for a long, long time. What was the atmosphere like in the courtroom?
Well, it was an enormously complicated case, and as Joe McGettigan pointed out, and I have to say, Nancy Schultz was a very important witness, which, I can only imagine how difficult that was, but she was a very strong part of the prosecution's case. But as Joe McGettigan pointed out, the bar is very high in Pennsylvania for not guilty by reason of insanity. And I think anyone who looked at this clinically understood that that was going to be a tough proposition for the defense. But as this deliberation dragged on, as Joe said, you never know what a jury is going to do. But they came back with a verdict that in the end had the result that the prosecution wanted, and that was that John DuPont never left prison.
That seemed like a fair verdict to you, Nancy?
I was a little concerned. It seemed like a very short time when 13 years, I still had children in the house, and he was being put up for parole. It seemed very short. I guess I have to say that I'm just glad that he died while he was still in prison.
You created a wrestling foundation in your husband's name. Tell us about it.
Well, right when Dave died, he was such a leader that a lot of the wrestlers kind of looked to me and were around me and supporting me in this terrible time. And it was right before the Olympic Games, so John, the Foxcatcher funding, obviously was gone. He was in prison, so I formed a nonprofit. The United States Olympic Committee helped me put some money in, and I began fundraising. And what was to be a three-month organization turned into a 12-year process, and I have to say it was one of the happiest times of my life. My children still remained around that giant international home of, family of wrestling, and they kind of, that whole family kind of carried me through for years and helped me raise my children.
And happy because they were there for you, and it did feel like a family for you?
It did, absolutely, and I was there for them, they were there for me, and for many, many years it was a tight group. I still serve on the boards of USA Wrestling and the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. I'm still involved, and I still enjoy my family of wrestling very much. They're my closest friends.
Are you a sporty person yourself?
I was a gymnast myself, but I'm pretty much 100% wrestling anymore.
And Bill, as you said, you have spent time as a sports writer. For people that don't know, I guess, the world of wrestling as Nancy has lived it, help us understand what this world is about.
Well, as Nancy has pointed out, wrestling is a very interesting, peculiar discipline. It's a real fraternity. And, and it's an individual sport, where each person is trying to pursue, their own accomplishments, their own goals. And yet, in getting to that point, they are helping each other. They're coaching each other. They're scrimmaging against each other. So it's sort of a very special sport in that way, where people are contributing to the talent and the skill of each other, and yet at the end of the day, they may wind up being competitors. And I think it breeds a very interesting brotherhood and camaraderie. How would you feel about that, Nancy?
Yeah, I was curious. How do you feel about it? Go ahead.
Absolutely, and not only within the nation, but it's such a sport. First of all, it doesn't get much, assistance financially. So you're always helping each other. And when we traveled to Russia, we would sometimes sleep on, the athletes' floors at their house, and we would end up getting to know their families and their children. I have friends from Bulgaria and Azerbaijan and Georgia and things like that are true friends because we spent time traveling with our families together and supporting each other in a way that I think most sports don't need that kind of support because they have it more financially than they do in camaraderie.
Yeah, but it can't be that kind of camaraderie. I'm curious, Nancy, how are your kids doing and how old are they now?
My children are lovely. I actually was going to go to Conn, but my son graduated from the University of San Francisco with honors.
Good for him.
So I chose to be there instead of going to France. And my daughter has a lovely place in Woodside, California, where she raises organic vegetables and fruits. And they're both doing lovely, thanks to all of the big uncles and the wrestling family that helped me raise them.
And does your son wrestle?
He had his round a little bit when he was in high school, but his father, Dave always taught my children to do what you love. You can only be great when you try to do something that you love.
As you said, you were going to go to Cannes to see Foxcatcher. I'm assuming you'll see it when it comes out in the United States. Do you feel like you have to prepare yourself for someone else to tell this story?
No, I was on the set quite a bit and worked with Bennett Miller and Mark Ruffalo, and I have to say thanks to them. They treated Dave's character. The Foxcatcher movie is really Mark's film. It's really about Mark Schultz and his struggle, yes. But the character of Dave Schultz is portrayed very, with great respect and with honor to his memory.
And how is Mark doing?
Mark is good. Mark lives in Oregon. We see him. I just was with him. His daughter just was married, and our whole family got together for the wedding.
So, Bill, about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye. So, are there Are there lessons we can learn from this terrible, tragic story?
You know, we going back to that word enabling. The lesson is an old lesson that, you know, money buys influence and influence buys privilege, and we always have to be mindful of that. I mean, that's, you know, we're all here talking because a wonderful person, you know, perished. And he perished because, I think, because of the corrupting influences of money. And that's kind of the bigger theme that comes out of this.
And for you, Nancy, about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye, what is your takeaway?
I think Dave was such a good friend of John's, and although John was a troubled soul, I think Dave never suspected that John could cause harm. Mm. And he wanted to be his friend to the very end. He was pushing John to get help. And I think, you know, it was his friendship that ended up causing him problems.
Well, he sounds like quite a guy. And Nancy Schultz, I really appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. I know this has got to be tough for you to talk about, but such an important part of our conversation today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty. It's a joy to share Dave's memory.
Indeed. And Nancy Schultz, the wife of wrestler Dave Schultz. Bill Ordean, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he covered the trial of John DuPont for the Philadelphia Inquirer, co-authored a book with Ralph Vigoda called Fatal Match. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant, with help today from Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.